Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City, NPR News Talk 90.7, putting Delmarva first. It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
What were you doing 10 years ago on September 11th? It was the day that saw the country enter a new era after two planes crashed into the World Trade Center and another struck the Pentagon. This is Don Rush, and welcome to Delmarva Today. This morning, we reflect on those fateful events and what they mean a decade later. Our in-studio guests are Rosemary Thomas. She is executive director of the Salisbury University Foundation and also Professor Jim Hadley, who teaches philosophy at the university. Also by phone, we have Tim Kaine, a former Salisbury University student who worked at the World Trade Center and completed a three-month internship with New York Mayor's Office of Emergency Management. After the 9/11 attack, he was called back. But first, to set the stage, we want to present an interview we did with Gail Phillips, who was working for the Mercantile Peninsula Bank that morning in Ocean City.
The morning of 9/11, I was attending a board meeting for a Diaconia, a shelter program in West Ocean City. We did not have any television or anything, of course, during the meeting or radio. We all departed, and my office at that time was on 130th Street. So I, of course, was driving down Coastal Highway and became very concerned that there was no traffic. And the further I went, the more concerned, because I was not meeting or passing any cars. And I really, the thought occurred to me, something has happened. So I stopped at one of the branch offices, and when I went in, I said, "What's going on?" They asked me to come with them to where the television was, and they said, "You're not going to believe what has happened." Just as I entered their media room, the second plane hit. And that's where I was that day. And, of course, the feeling will never leave. And so we kind of kept up with it from there. Ocean City, you could hear a pin drop. It was interesting. I mean, there was nothing on the road. It really captured everyone's attention. So after that, many, many of my customers met with me and gave me their stories. And it happened that I had one in particular that was in New York when this happened, and her story was so interesting. She and her husband, who were working in the financial district, and she was on her way to the Trade Center, had slept in that morning, got up, did not know what was happening in New York, started to work, and realized something was happening. And just as she was approaching one area where you would turn, the buildings collapsed. One of the first buildings collapsed. And a gentleman grabbed her, came running down the street and grabbed her and took her down to the river. And they have concrete embankments going down. And he put her there. The force of the debris coming down the street knocked her shoes off. And he told her, he said, "Lay here, do not get up." He says, "Until you hear some kind of quiet around you," he says, "do not move." And of course, that impact, that was one of her stories. And then there were others, you know, they went on and on. We had one customer, he had retired the week before, and everyone in his building, of course, vanished. And so Ocean City really felt it, and felt it from a lot of people. The stories just go on and on.
Gail Phillips, who was working for Mercantile Peninsula Bank that morning in Ocean City. Why don't I now turn to Tim Kaine? He's a former Salisbury University student, and he had completed a three-month internship with the New York Mayor's Office of Emergency Management and then was called back after 9/11. Tim, let me first of all turn to you and ask you, where were you when you first heard the news and realized what was going on that day?
Sure. I was in a in Chesapeake dorm room on the campus at Salisbury University, and my brother, who lived in New York at the time, called me that morning to wake me up to tell me that a plane had flown into the towers. I had worked at 7 World Trade Center, which is the tower just north of the of the two twin towers that collapsed later that day. And I thought he was joking when he called me. And, you know, he said, you know, "Tim, I'm not joking. Turn on the television." And as I turned on the television, that's when I saw the second plane coming to the second tower.
And what was your reaction? What was your sense about what was going on?
Well, at first I assumed it had to be, you know, there are planes that fly in New York. It was actually something I sort of got used to, these sort of seaplanes that fly around New York. And I assumed it was some sort of accident. And then, you know, as I'm talking to my brother and turning on the television and the second plane hit, you know, I just knew that something was sort of, you know, terribly wrong and that it wasn't an accident.
Now, you were then went back up to New York to help out with the rescue efforts. What was it like going back into the city, certainly a city that you had been working in for some time, had some familiarity with? What was the scene like?
Well, as I took the train into the city, I had my parents drop me off in Wilmington, and I took the train in. I had been sitting next to an elderly lady, and the train was packed because nobody wanted to fly. And I think a lot of people thought we would be going around New York. And so when we started to go into New York, there was a lot of tension. And I was the only person who stood up to get off in New York. And this elderly woman grabbed me and told me not to get off the train. And, you know, I told her it was going to be okay. And I came out of Penn Station, and there were no taxis and no one on the street. This is, I think, the morning of September 13th, and the city was just quiet. And I walked down to the police academy, which is where sort of the office was temporarily operating out of. And later that night, went down to Ground Zero for the first time and got out of a car and had no idea where I was. Only to realize it was the very corner that I bought coffee every morning for 3 months. But had no idea because, you know, everything was just covered in white and, you know, there was no power and it was just eerily quiet. And so it was certainly a very sort of strange and in a lot of ways a very different city, you know, in those days after.
So now you helped with some of the rescue efforts. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that you know, in a sense, I sort of feel blessed that I had the opportunity to help. I think that everyone wanted to help. And I spent the 11th calling my old office and finally got my boss on the phone who told me to get up there any way I could. And, you know, I spent the next 3 weeks sort of working to sort of help the city and do what I could, whether it would be coordinate other relief efforts or getting the debris, sort of helping manage that process. It was certainly sort of a very strange time, you know, of sort of sleepless nights and, you know, doing anything you could to sort of try to make things better.
What was the sense like in the city in terms of the people that you were dealing with? Was it just simply very focused, or did people express other emotions? What was that like?
Yeah, I mean, I think it. I think there was an amazing amount of focus, sort of after. I always say, like, after sort of the first maybe 72 hours. I mean, I think that the city was sort of, you know, rocked, you know, to its core, trying to figure out how to sort of pick itself up again. And that's what the city had to do, is sort of figure out how to become sort of focused on making the situation, you know, better and in ways that, you know, could be. And, you know, I think there were a range of, you know, people, different emotions, and people certainly reacted, you know, very differently, but probably all appropriately.
Final along those lines, were you able to get up to Ground Zero at all during that period of time? Did you have any interaction at all there? What was that like?
Yeah, I mean, I was there the night of September 13th and was there, you know, probably daily after that. And, you know, it was a, you know, an organized chaos, you know, over, that's what it became over time. It was completely unrecognizable for anybody who's sort of ever been there or seen it on television or you know, lived there. I mean, I think it just became totally changed. You couldn't figure out where you were. But the amount of people sort of down there sort of helping was astonishing, actually.
Oh, and I turn to Rosemary Thomas. She's the executive director of the Salisbury University Foundation. And I will ask the same thing to you. First of all, do you remember where you were when you heard about it? And what was your reaction? What was that like?
I was working on the campus of Glenville State College, which is located in central West Virginia, small, remote area, very rural. And my pager went off. And I had a pager on my hip, and I looked down, and it was my best friend calling. And so I stepped out of a meeting that was about to start and called her back, and she said, "Have you talked to Sam?" Sam is my biological father who lives and works in New York. I said, "Yeah, actually, I talked to him about a half an hour ago." And she said, "Well, you need to call him back." The world just changed, and the first plane had struck. So by the time I reached out to Sam, he was certainly hysterical and worrying and concerned, because his wife worked with Cantor Fitzgerald, one of the only female partners with that firm, and on the 102nd floor of the first tower to be hit. And so he was trying desperately to figure out what he could do, where she was, how he could reach out to her, what could be done. And so I quickly became the face of 9/11 for that small rural community, and went in, handed my president a sticky note, and said, "The World Trade Center's just been hit by a plane. Reason to believe it may not have been accidental." And I took off across the campus. And by the time I got to my office, much like the lady we heard from Ocean City, I made my way to a television station just in time to see the second strike. I got in my car and hurried home because I was trying to get to my 90-year-old grandfather, because I knew he'd be frightened and he'd be worried about, where is everybody? Is everybody okay? And by the time I got home to gather up my things to go there, I watched the plane strike the Pentagon. And at that point, it just became surreal. And I remember thinking, this really isn't happening. And I kept trying to call Sam. I kept calling him back and calling him back. And I thought, I need to quit calling him, because I quickly realized every time the phone rang, he was hoping it was Val. And so I took a step back and I said, you know what? I'm going to wait to hear from you. Let's plan on talking every hour or so. And he said, "Okay, just stay with me, just stay with me." And I did. And by the time I got to Clarksburg, which was about 45 minutes to an hour away, unfortunately, the building had begun to collapse. And I remember him saying, he did call at that point, and he said, "I'm not scared anymore." He said, "I'm devastated." And I remember saying, "Well, tell me the difference." And he said, "Because in 1993, when the bombing had occurred down in the subway tunnel, it took Val's office 3.5 hours to descend the staircase, and it had been about 96 minutes at that point."
So when you learned about what had happened, what did you do next? What was your sense about it all?
I was trying to figure out a way that from, you know, 8 hours away, I could somehow protect Sam from what he was going to have to deal with and what he was going to have to go through. And it was virtually impossible to do. And what I tried to do was reach out to people along the way, because he left his Times Square office and began heading toward the financial district. And his business partner and I were calling people along the way, trying to get them to intercept him, because the last place he needed to be was at Ground Zero. And he really wasn't going there. And what we later found out, and it was sad, and we were just trying to keep some hope alive for him, but at the same time, we had to be realistic. We realized that what he was doing was he was taking photographs of Val and going to the various hospitals. And unfortunately, as you all well know, as we're all well aware, medical professionals from around the country and around the world came to try to be helpful. And unfortunately, there were very few that they were able to help or necessary to help. And so I guess the next thing I did was try to provide some type of hope for finding answers, because at that point, I don't think we knew we weren't going to find Val.
When you search for answers, what kind of answers were you searching for?
It was very interesting. I remember Sam saying that he would get phone calls day after day, and people would say, "How you doing?" And he said, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, he would say, "Not bad for someone who a terrorist tried to land a plane on my wife's desk 2 days ago or 3 days ago or whatever." And I do give him so much credit for being a realist. And I think having gone through it in 93, he perhaps had a little different take on what the reality was. I guess the sad thing was that we knew that since 93, so for 7 years, Val wasn't real keen on working on that 102nd floor. You know, she really wasn't. And she wasn't real keen on what that building symbolized, so to speak. The one thing that was very interesting was when I finally went to New York, and he had asked me to wait, and so I went a week later. He called and said, "Please, please come now." And he said, I remember driving into the city with him. I, too, took a train and got partway there, and he drove out, and he said, "There's where it isn't." And you pointed, and you could still see the cloud of smoke. The saddest part may have been that when we went to the Red Cross setup, which was on the piers down on the river, they had called him and said, "Can you please bring us additional DNA samples, hairbrush, toothbrush, those types of things, and we'd like to get a photo of your wedding band," if they were matching wedding bands, because that's how they were doing a lot of the identification. And when we went there, the humbling part and the part that made you proud to be an American was the work that the Red Cross was doing and all those volunteers. They had it set up with 20, 30, 40 languages that you went to this line or that line, whatever you needed. But the sad part and the heart-wrenching part was there were people there after 1 week who were reporting their loved ones missing for the very first time. They had held out hope that long and then decided maybe we better let someone know.
I want to turn to you, Jim. Sure. Just briefly, how did you learn about 9/11?
It was a beautiful day here, almost beatific, and before going to classes, I was spending a bit of time gardening. Went in, looked at my email, and saw the AOL news thing on one of the towers being hit. Nobody knew quite what it was, right? That surrealness. Then turned on the TV and saw the second plane hit, I believe. I can't really remember. Saw the buildings crash all alone. I'm a bachelor. Have a daughter in New York City, so I was worrying about her, trying to call her. And just started screaming out loud in my living room, just screaming. I didn't know what else to do. Finally got a hold of my daughter later that evening, and the thing that I remember heartened her the most was the fact that everyone in the entire city put out candles along all of the streets. It was one of those first acts of consolidation. And for her, you know, it was much more distant than for Rosemary and the other people we've heard, and Tim. But, of course, she went through it as a citizen. And then, you know, later that week, I began teaching again, particularly my intro class, and all the different varieties of reactions, including people who were involved with people who may have to go to war and were realizing all of a sudden that, you know, being in the Army was a whole new different sort of thing. Also people who had lost people or knew people who had lost people. And then just the rest of the students saying, "What is this? You know, I'm not ready for this. You know, I came here to have a good time." And, you know, this incredible surrealness. I think one of the things that historical violence often has as a characteristic, and this I know from having worked on the Holocaust and memorializing the Holocaust, is that it's often much more surreal than anything we could imagine. It beggars the imagination. And hearing all the details again of Rosemary's story and Tim's story and the lady from Ocean City, it reminds you how many details are involved, how many different moments of consciousness and activity and commitment and loss are involved in this thing, moment, event, mystery that we are trying to somehow find our way to as we commemorate for the 10th time 9/11.
Of course, it has been now 10 years, or almost 10 years, Sunday. Tim, I want to turn to you briefly and ask you what kind of reflections you have over this past 10 years about what's happened. A great deal has happened, a couple of wars and so on, elections. What's your sense about, have we learned anything? What's your sense about 9/11 now as opposed to back then?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't know how much we've learned or not learned. I mean, I think that, you know, New York as a city, I still live and work in New York. I work downtown, two blocks away from Ground Zero. And, you know, I think that I remember the first anniversary going to work that day. I was 22 and thinking, you know, I needed to write a will because, you know, I sort of felt like, oh, I don't know that this is really safe today. And I don't think that exists in New York anymore. And, you know, maybe it's been replaced with the normalcy and the, you know, sort of the high-paced life of New York. But you do sort of feel like every September 11th that the city sort of slows down again and tries to sort of, you know, remember, you know, what was lost that day.
And Rosemary, what about you as you reflect?
Couple of things that really jump out. One would be the phone call that I got from Sam, 9/11, 2002. Ironically enough, the police had been trying to reach him for about 10 days, and he'd been in and out of town, and they'd been playing a little bit of phone tag, and they actually reached him on September 10th, 2002, to make him aware that they had indeed found some remains and DNA. And I was so thankful for that, because while he had found ways to deal with the situation on a personal level, you know, it's different. It's different than a situation where someone dies of cancer, dies of a heart attack, is taken unexpectedly even by an automobile accident. It's a city that was in pain, and he chose to remain there and live there, and I certainly respected that. But this gave him a feeling of closure, and I think he was somewhat proud of himself that he wasn't surprised by that call, that he had held out to hear that and wanted to know that indeed she had been found. And he knew, you know, then that unfortunately the inevitable, the bad dream, was reality. Another memory would be from just a few months ago during Bin Laden's capture and demise. And I remember calling not only Sam, but members of Val's family, who I'm still very close with, and just saying, just thinking of you. And the messages back and the conversations that we had after that were, you know what? We don't believe in an eye for an eye, but by the same token, when people are taken out of greed, out of frustration, for religious purposes, whatever the case may be, there has to be some type of justice, because whether we believe, whether it's a political decision, a religious decision, a financial decision, we do live in what we believe is a just society. And they did feel some level of justice. And so I guess, you know, the reflection for me is to say that perhaps justice was done.
Jim, what do you think we've learned? What do you think you personally have learned, but also as a nation?
Learned. I maybe learn how to learn. You know, that's the philosophical answer. You know, there are many levels of loss. At one level, it starts with the individual, people like Rosemary. At another level, it's a city, people like Tim and myself. And then it's, you know, a bigger level. It's all the kids who went to Iraq and Afghanistan. It's also all the people who were there as those wars went on and died. It's, you know, so much loss, but it's also a total change in the worldview that we are now experiencing. I mean, when Rosemary said the world changed, that's precisely what happened. Part of what makes 9/11 such a complicated event is there's deep personal loss, and in the first sense, the people who lost their loved ones, they own this time, this place. They are the ones most responsible and most most to be listened to. But at the same time, we have to notice that almost everyone in the world was affected by this event. It's that sort of event. And so the issue of justice is raised, not only the justice of what happens to the perpetrators of this event, but what this signals for living in a world that searches for justice. You know, the biblical command of not to eat my people like bread, and not only our people, but any people. And how do we equate this? How do we translate this into a policy in dealing not only with those we identify with, the perpetrators, but all other human beings? We've probably made huge mistakes, but we've also, I think, had, you know, creative moments. And I think at some level, we need to remember that this all begins before a political or ideological stance. You know, the loss of a human being and the surrealness of this loss are signals that, you know, this is more than just what I can achieve. There's something here that calls for an accountability that none of us will ever truly fulfill completely. So that learning to learn is learning to learn our limitations, but also learning to pursue what the good is, and, you know, when the good is threatened, to understand how that threat should be responded to. Now, that's at least a few thoughts.
Do you think that perhaps we are losing some of those lessons, that we're losing the impact of 9/11? It's been 10 years later. A whole group of set of kids have grown up since then, and some kids who are on this campus right now, they certainly was a major event in their lives, but those who come after, not so much. Do you think that perhaps some of that is drifting away? Jim, what do you think?
Well, I think that there's a sort of history to history, if I can. Just like any event, the 4th of July, right? You know, as the last sign of the Declaration of Independence died, this is part of what it means to be in history. And part of what it means to be in history is to remember, and to remember well. So I think that it's not so much that there's a diluting as there is a deepening, and perhaps also an additional complication that comes with the passing of time, with yet other possibilities, but not to lose that which was truly compelling and calling for our attention in this event. And, you know, the jury's still out on that. I mean, I think the jury will be out as long as there's a United States. That's why we have these days of commemoration, to come back again and ask ourselves precisely the question you just asked me. Are we losing it? Have we done enough? What can we understand now and here about what that meant then in that place?
Rosemary, what do you think? You deal with students all the time.
Sure. I think that patriotism ebbs and flows, if you will. And I guess that perhaps the best thing to do is be thankful for the flow, because it happens. You know, I remember people asking my mom and my dad, where were you when JFK was shot? I remember during my senior year in high school, we happened to have a snow day in West Virginia, and we were all home and watched the space shuttle be accidentally destroyed. This is one of those things. This is one of those situations, as Jim said, it's historical. It is history. I'm sorry that I had to watch my family go through the pain of what's going to go in the history books, but I'm thankful that we have the resilience and the appreciation and the respect for what this country stands for to maintain confidence, to maintain love and admiration, and to continue to hope that while patriotism does ebb and flow, that we can maintain a level of pride, a level of respect for one another, and certainly a level of reverence for those lives that were lost.
We've been speaking with Rosemary Thomas. She's executive director of the Salisbury University Foundation. Also, Professor Jim Hatley, who teaches philosophy on the university campus. Also by phone, we had Tim Kaine, a former Salisbury University student who worked at the World Trade Center and also was up there after 9/11. And we also heard an interview with Gail Phillips, who was working for the Mercantile Peninsula Bank that morning in Ocean City. This is Don Rush. You've been listening to Delmarva Today, and thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Our volunteer producers are Penny Hartman, Kathleen Grout, and Jim White. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC 14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit pac14.org.